A warning. This podcast contains adult language, accounts of sexual abuse, suicidal thoughts, and other deeply sensitive material. Please use discretion. Previously on Terminal, The Dying Church Planter. 30 worried people crowded into a not yet fully renovated room.
The best way to describe that mood, it feels very cold, kind of like a morgue.
And one nervous man stood before them on a hastily constructed stage.
He tried about 3 different times, and then he said, "I got something I got to share."
And when he finally spoke, there were 30 different reactions.
Terminal's a big word.
And so I was shocked.
I had to sit down.
My heart sank.
And we sat in silence for like 10 minutes.
And then, once Richard Pope finally told his church plant launch team his cancer was terminal, there were 30 people with one decision to make.
I said to them, "If you want me to do this, I will. But if you guys don't want to do it, then it's done."
I'm Tony Hudson, and this is Terminal, The Dying Church Planter, Episode 5, where 30 or more are gathered. Hallmark does not make a greeting card for it. There is no masterclass, no TED Talk, no BuzzFeed article entitled "Top 10 Best Ways to Tell Friends and Family You Are Terminally Ill." But an extremely wise man once said, "There is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." And so, after Richard Pope told his wife the news, but before that sad Sunday when he told everyone else, he made one phone call.
"I'm Jamie Caldwell. I'm the church planting catalyst for our region." So, Richard's journey to church planting took a lot of twists and turns through a variety of denominational affiliations and church stuff, and that's where I met him, and I just got to kind of walk with him and shepherd him through. So he really is a friend.
When he called you and told you, how was he taking it?
Not well. I mean, I grew up in a pastor's home, and I've pastored my church for 10 years and been in ministry for 20, so it's not the first time you hear news about cancer or somebody being terminal. But it was one of the more unexpected conversations I ever had. It was just shocking.
This is probably where he became like, I'm closer to him than my siblings. You know what I mean? Like, he's my brother. And I said, "Jamie, what do I do?" And I'm like, "I don't know how I'm gonna plant a church, blah, 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 blah." He said, "Richard, I don't care about your church. What about you? Nobody's gonna be mad if you don't plant a church. How are you feeling?" And I just sobbed, telling him. I was terrified. I was scared. I'm not trying to be like pessimistic, but I admit I have been through a lot even before the cancer. And I was like, why would God do this to me, man? And Jamie said the most aggravating and wise thing. He said, "To make you more like Jesus." He said, "Everything you experience is sanctification." And that's what Romans 8:28 means, that all things might not be good, but all things, even bad things, are working together for your good. And that broke me.
I think that was probably the most calm I've ever seen him. I think sometimes that's what pastors do. It helps them deal with grief. They don't get emotional. They just kind of step into a shepherding role. And I think he did that even for himself. And honestly, one of his first questions, like when I realized the direction things were going to go, he said, "Okay, so now that I have cancer, is Sin Network going to cut my funding?" And I was like, "No, but are you still going to plant the church? Like, is this what you want to do?" And he said, "Well, I mean, if God called me to plant a church and God knew that I was going to get cancer, then God must want me to plant a church with cancer."
The following Sunday, when 30 worried people crowded into a not-yet-renovated room, and Richard stepped up onto a hastily constructed stage to speak to them, that is what he said.
He was taking these deep breaths, and so it was obvious that whatever he was going to share wasn't good.
Keith Conkle, who is now Richard's executive pastor, was there that day.
I've known Richard since he was like 18. Good kid. When you're 61, you can say kid, right? Good kid, good young man. And he got up there and he shared the diagnosis. And I felt like the Holy Spirit was kind of saying, we can just continue to move forward. So I just got up and just walked forward. And I said, you know, right in the middle of COVID. And I said, listen, I know everybody's afraid of COVID. Everybody's afraid. But I think we all need to lay hands and pray over this man. And everybody in that church gathered around him. A little emotional. And then prayed over him.
I just remember them gathering around me, that team of like 30 people now, just praying. I thought Keith was going to pray over me, and everyone was praying. And I heard, you know, just some of the things that stand out in my memory. Lord, heal our pastor. These people were claiming me as their pastor, right? Like, I was their pastor. They were my friends, and they just loved me, and they shepherded me in that moment. And they affirmed me and affirmed God's calling in my life. And that's when I realized I don't have a launch team, I have a church.
But then something gracious happened.
David Elliott was also one of the 30 people there that day.
God started stirring within the hearts of all the people there. This prayer over them, be like, hey, we're still here. We're still ready to start this church. God showed it to you as a canvas before. Then let's paint the canvas.
Sometimes stubbornness can be a spiritual gift. The launch team's decision to keep going was unanimous. And so with just 1 month left, the countdown clock to Canvas Church's Launch Sunday restarted. Once more, with feeling.
That Sunday, I had a canvas up on stage and I said, write the name of one person you want to come on Launch Sunday. And I remember people writing and they would come up, they'd write the name and they'd pray, God, bring this person. Literally, we prayed over that canvas. And I said, now your challenge is to go find your sheep.
This was something brand new for me, even to kind of wrap my mind around and understand what it was we were doing.
This is Sarah Altman.
And as Launch Sunday got closer, we were out doing community service, passing out door knockers, letting people know that we were starting a church. But it was just a continuous, just going out into the neighborhoods that our church was closest to really let them know, like, this is a new church. And like, I had no idea where it was gonna lead and what this journey was gonna look like, but I was like, I'm in. And then I look back and I'm like, oh, should have thought about that before I said, because it's like almost an immediate yes. I'm like, Richard's asked me to do something, I'm gonna do it. Because this man here is living literally his last days for the Lord. So I don't have an excuse. I've got to share the word. I've got to spread the word.
The Greek word dunamis is used 120 times in the New Testament. Roughly translated, it means miraculous power. It's where we get the word for dynamite. Dunamis is what happened that last month in Salisbury.
His launch team wasn't composed of a whole bunch of career Christians.
This is Jamie Caldwell.
They were new believers who had a lot of friends and family that didn't know Jesus. So him having cancer wasn't a strategic logistical problem for them. It was a spiritual thing because I think they feel like there's a clock on it. And that clock has pushed them into activity that they would have done anyway. I honestly believe that. The way they loved the gospel, the way they cared about their neighbors, but the new intensity on we need to do this right now created a cohesiveness to the mission that I've not seen very many places. because they took it so seriously. It's almost like the Great Commission was for them.
Hey, guys. All right, there's way more of you in here. Let's have some energy. Hey, guys. All right, we're definitely going to get a ticket from the fire marshal. Hey.
And so, on April 4th, 2021, when the launch Sunday countdown clock struck zero, there was, at first, an encouraging response.
We thank you for the good news. I was like, man, what if we have 50 people come?
Lord, we thank you that this space.
And launch Sunday, 97 people came.
We worship you, knowing you're present, you love us, and you care for us. And all God's people said.
And then 7 days later, there was a not so encouraging response.
Of course, the next week there were like 40 people here. And I go down and I preach, but I'm literally standing next to the trash can the whole time.
It's hard to start a church. It's harder still to grow a church, especially when almost every single Sunday, the order of worship is sing, puke, preach, puke.
There was one time I was playing the cajon, and I played the first song. And, you know, when you play cajon, you bend down. And I bend down, and I catch it in my mouth, and I literally sprint out of the service, middle of worship, and I welch in the toilet for like 5 minutes, whole song. Ew, please don't do it now. Yeah, and I come out of the bathroom, and my executive pastor and kids pastor are there with like Gatorade water and paper towels and Tums. And then at one point while I'm preaching, I just stop for like, I'd say it felt like an hour. Peyton would say it was like 60 seconds. And I just stand over that trash can.
The third Sunday passed, and then the fourth, and then the fifth. And in spite of Richard, or because of Richard, or maybe both, 40 people became 60, 60 became 80, and 80 became 100.
We said, go find your sheep. And it happened, man. So that 40 over the summer, it just grew. And this is crazy to me because I'm not the best preacher. And we're not ridiculously flashy. We have church. We invite people to church. And we send people out of the church. And that is not flashy. But yeah, people sit there and they keep coming back.
In their first 6 months, Canvas Church baptized dozens of new believers. They outgrew their space. They started to pray about starting a second church. Richard was now more successful than he could have ever imagined. And yet, he was still dying. And his monsters were still stirring.
So I always feel slightly sick. Sometimes I feel very sick. And I don't know how much longer I'm going to be preaching. And still God's church is growing. I don't know. Like all these passages of scriptures that we hold on to, these truths, like everybody loves Jeremiah 29:11. If I know the plans I have for you, do you know what was happening when God said that to him? And then in Isaiah, we see that prophecy, right? Definitely talking about Israel, but I think it applies to the church, that he'll exchange their ashes for a beautiful headdress. It never says the ashes don't happen. But there's still the question, because I don't think we actually have the answer to why God lets bad things happen. Like, I have my theological answer, but our souls still ask God why.
That is the question Richard could not shake. And so one morning, sitting as he often did in a hospital waiting area, he looked that monster directly in the eye and wrote down his own very personal lamentation.
I wrote it about, I was visiting the hospital, and I got so pissed because literally all the flowers in the courtyard were dead, and they just left them there, and it really bothered me, like pissed me off. So I'm mad at the hospital for being so lackadaisical, and I'm mad that the doctors can't save me. I'm also mad at God. So, yeah.
We asked Richard to read what he wrote that day.
You know what's weird? I don't get nervous when I preach. I get nervous when I read poetry.
Even though he's obviously more comfortable writing poetry than reading it out loud.
I'm really going to do it this time. I'm just working myself up. Why did you let the flowers die? They call this a place of healing, but all I smell is death. A grotesque picture of life leaving as the flowers lose their breath. They sit in the shade of darkness, void of any hope or resuscitation. They were abandoned in curtness, left to dwell on their coming destruction. Why did you let the flowers die? This is supposed to be a place of healing, yet you let death linger in your courtyard. Why did you let the flowers die? They call this a place of healing, but all I see is hopelessness. A horrible sight of what is coming as the flowers lie on the ground motionless. They don't move, and no one visits. As their former beauty is long forgotten, they were left to be consumed by the crickets. They're consumed by the rotten mass. Why did you let the flowers die? This is supposed to be a place of healing, yet you let death linger in your courtyard. Why did you let the flowers die? They call this a place of healing, but all I taste is my regret. A bitter flavor of leaving so early, as the flowers' eyes are still wet. They just lie there with nothing to do, too late to see any more sunrises. They were abandoned by you, and now they have to feel the night rising. Why did you let the flowers die? This is supposed to be a place of healing, yet you let death linger in the courtyard. Why did you let the flowers die? They call this a place of healing, but all I hear is the lament of my soul. I gave you what I had, but you are leaving. Are you ashamed that I never met my goals? The flowers are so boring to look at. Why isn't death more interesting? They wither into the ground overtook, crushed by the foundation they were trusting. Why did you let the flowers die? This is supposed to be a place of healing. Yet you let death linger in your courtyard. Why did you let the flowers die? They call this a place of healing, but all I needed was a touch of your hand. I waited, but I guess now I am leaving. Will you be there when this all comes to the end? The flowers have withered, but still your word remains. Now I'm watching my own life flicker, but still your word remains. Why did you let the flowers die? This is supposed to be a place of healing. Yet you let death linger in your courtyard. Why did you let the flowers die?
Maybe it's irony or coincidence, or maybe it's something more meaningful. As I'm writing the script for this particular episode, I'm sitting in a hospital waiting room. I'm not here for me, at least not this time. I'm here for my daughter. We have to take her to see lots of doctors. There's a window in this waiting room, but there are no flowers outside, just concrete. Alive or dead, doesn't matter. I wish there were flowers. Ecclesiastes 7:14 says, "When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider this. God has made one as well as the other." And so, with that in mind, coming up on episode 6 of Terminal, The Dying Church Planter. There are now people in Salisbury, Maryland, with outlandish stories to tell.
Everybody has a story, you know, like I'll tell you my story, and there are people here who will tell you their story.
In this episode, you'll hear the improbable account of how a dying man showed one, then two, then three people how to live.
It's like God's not even waiting to make good come out of this.
And then you'll hear what Canvas Church decided to do with all of those newly alive people.
I fell in love with everything that they were doing, everything that Canvas was about. And honestly, that's where I kind of like had this interest that then turned into like a calling and a passion. And it just kind of snowballed from there.
The story of Richard II and Richard III and other far-fetched things on the next episode of Terminal, The Dying Church Planter. You can find photos, videos, and other bonus material. And you can learn more about church planting with Send Network at terminalchurchplanter.com.